diameter orbit. The larger diameter orbit will make you move slower, and therefore the distance between you and the thing you want to meet up with will increase. Opposite of common sense. So if it's going to be something like a quarter of an orbit or a half an orbit before you're going to get there, you literally have to blast your rocket toward the target so that you feel like you're slowing down. Yes, you are. You slow down, and then within a quarter of an orbit, you go to a lower orbit. You will then go down, under, and ahead of them, if you know what I mean. So to do a link up in space is really a complicated maneuver, and a lot of it is opposite of common sense. I wonder if you've seen some of the mechanics of this one, Paul. WS2N, K2LAW.
Well, yeah, in this movie, a lot of that is, they kind of like throw out the window. First of all, I mean, it's STS-154, we only got up to 135. When the movie was made, they didn't even figure that the space shuttle program was going to be canceled, so it's somewhat supposed to be into the future. He's riding around with the MMU, the Man Maneuvering Unit, and they did away with those things after they realized they weren't safe, or, you know, this was not going to be a standard operating procedure. What they did develop out of that is the Safer Pack, which all astronauts have on the EVAs now, in case they wander away from the space station, they can't get themselves back. So based on that, I mean, he's riding around with an MMU, and so she didn't, she didn't have the MMU on, he did. And he pulled her all the way to the ISS deck. They just, you know, kept firing their jets, going in the right direction, and eventually they got there. So, you gotta catch the movie, Dick. It's interesting. They got a lot right. She's in that Shenzhou spacecraft, the way that broke up. She's in the center part. I mean, Shenzhou is it's a copy of the Soyuz spacecraft. So, the way that broke up to, that broke up properly, and then she re-entered the atmosphere, okay. So, I mean, they got some things right, so that's why you got to watch it, and you can get a kick out of all the things that they got wrong. Back to you, Dick.
Now, you told me they've given up on the manned maneuverable unit, but when the astronauts are doing a EVA, extravehicular activity, they do have a so-called safer unit, is what you described. Give me a few words, Paul, and what is the safer unit? Where is it located on the spacesuit? How much thrust does it give you for how much time? Because even using a thing like that, I mean, I guarantee the astronauts are told over and over again, no matter what you do, make sure that lanyard that's connected to you, that piece of wire with the equivalent of a carabiner on the end of it, make sure it is attached to something. Never let go of a handhold until you're sure you're attached. Very similar to me climbing my tower. I never let go of that tower until I've got a lanyard wrapped around the tower. Two of them, in fact. I like redundancy. And so you've got to be attached. If they start floating free, to recapture them can be extremely difficult. And then let me drop... Even if you've got some kind of a thrusting device, let's assume now that you're doing a spacewalk in the cargo hold of the shuttle, and you go wandering off in some direction because you didn't attach yourself, and now you think you're just going to blast yourself back. When you come back to the shuttle, you better make sure you come back to a place that's got a handhold. If, for instance, you came back to the nose cone, that great big round nose cone on the shuttle, where there's nothing to grab onto. At the instant you touch it, it will bounce off of it and go back into space. You've got to make sure that whenever you come back, you've got something to grab onto at the instant you make impact. Otherwise, you're going to bounce away. So what does a safer unit look like, Paul? And I bet you they're taught to make sure they're always attached, because using it, I think, is the last resort. WS2N, K2LAW.
Okay, and I think Alan will agree that the actors were very good in the show, and very entertaining, so I think you gotta get that movie. The SAPER pack is it's an acronym now, so I forget what the word SAPER stands for. But it's the last thing that they put on when they're getting ready for an EVA, and it's the first thing that comes off. You know, they'll be in the suit, the pack will be on, regular, you know, backpack with the cooling units and the oxygen and water and everything, and then this other unit attaches to their back. Looks like it's, I don't know, maybe 3 inches in width, probably, I'm going to say, 2 feet long, it's got an offset to it, kind of like something like almost like a headrest in your back. That's probably what a tank's are, I remember reading. So, they call them the safety unit. All our astronauts go out with that. And you're able to fly nitrogen jets. How much time you got, I don't know. I don't remember. But it's supposed to be very, very good. Back to you, Dick.
To your knowledge, have they ever practiced with the SAPER unit? Because even doing a practice with it is extremely dangerous. If something goes wrong and you run out of fuel and you haven't yet gotten back to the shuttle, so to speak, or back to the space station.
Yes.
Because the space station, I think you and I concluded, is something like a million pounds of hardware. And if you think you're going to move the space station in order to catch up with an errant astronaut who's run out of thrusting fuel and he's floating free somewhere, if you think you're going to move that spacecraft and go capture him, oh boy, on paper it sounds good. To really do it is out of the question. How long ago did they practice it, and what was the backup on that practice, Paul? Was there a tether at the same time? I hope so. WS2N, K2LAW.
Yeah, they did it a couple of times in the cargo bag, and they were tethered, and that's how they space tested these things. So that was a long time ago. Wow. So naturally, they had it during the shuttle missions toward the probably the last half of the I would say better than the last half of all the shuttle missions. Now, of course, on all the EBAs on the space station. So, if you Google SAPER pack, SAPER astronaut pack or something, you'll get all the info on it, what it looks like. But, you know, you watch them don their space equipment, that's the last thing that goes on, or the first thing that comes off when they come through the Quest Lab. Back to you, Dick.
To even do an experiment with that when you're tethered, to make the tether long enough so that the experiment is a live test, even that represents a problem. Because if you do something wrong with the SAPER pack, where you're now coming to the end of your tether at high velocity, unless it's got some beautiful braking action built into it, you can easily come to the end of the tether and yank it out of whatever it's attached to. So, there's only 10 ways you can die in that operation. KC2RFN, tell me the rest of the movie that you liked, Alan. KC2RFN, K2RAW.
You know, Dick, you hit on a part that particularly upset me was when Clooney was flying around in his jetpack, he was able to tow Sandra Bullock's character around using a tether. And, of course, what would happen is, he'd start accelerating away, and then, of course, the tether would slack, and then it would get more and more taut until it finally grabbed her and snapped her. So he had, of course, to do several course changes, and each time she got snapped around. And all I could think of is, a chiropractor in space.
Yeah, when you're coming to the end of your tether, if the velocity of the tether tightening is not extremely small, you better have your hand on that tether acting as braking action. Because if you really do a whiplash on that tether and you yank it out of its attachment, however it's attached to your suit, there's a whole lot of ways you're going to become very unhappy. You yanked it out of your suit, maybe you're going to yank a hole, or if you break the tether, you're never going to rescue the person again. You got to be very careful with the tether. And when you do come back to whatever is your home point, whether it be the Hubble, the space, I said Hubble. Yeah, no, I meant the space shuttle, the International Space Station, whatever you come back to, you got to make sure it's got a handhold, because if you make contact, you're going to bounce off, and you ain't going to be happy. And if it happens when you're out of fuel, on top of that, when you start floating free in space, you better apply the corrective action real soon, because as the distance between you and the thing you want to connect with gets larger and larger, to take the amount of fuel you've got on board of your safe pack and do the right amount of thrusting of the right velocity in the right direction without running out of fuel, that maneuver becomes more and more difficult as time goes on. You better start the corrective action very soon. You see what I'm worried about here, Alan? KC2RFN, KQRIW.
Dick, you gotta see this. All the places they grab onto the space station. Dick's gotta see this, Alan.
I was just about to ask Dick to see the movie this coming week so we could discuss it. Because he's intuiting the entire movie, and he hasn't seen it. I would love you to see, Dick, you're right on the right track. I mean, everything that I saw and noticed, you're mentioning now just from, you know, working it through. But, I mean, aside from the entertainment value, which it is worth, you know, the time it is to watch the movie for entertainment value, but you're going to poke so many holes through it that you're going to be adding up. I must have dozens of them, and it would be fun to discuss. But when we're out of space, I have a real down to earth technical question, not related to this, but more to what you were talking about earlier as a technist.
Yeah, give me a couple of words on this one, Alan. Don't worry about spoiling my entertainment. I'd still enjoy the movie, even if you tell me what's coming. And then after you tell me whatever you want to about the movie, go ahead with your question. KC2RFN, KQRIW.
Well, my question's not related to the movie. Is that all right?
You got the floor. You're number one on the runway, Alan. By the way, I hope you got that email I sent you. When you get a chance to see it, I think you'll find some of it's pretty good information.
Yeah, I got it, Dick, and I have to say it's disturbing, if nothing else. I want to read through it again, I have some concerns about it, which I'll email back to you. But I already went over the material. The question we're in about how I knew why boss up and everybody's happy, but is the reason for the mercury vapor, which is turned into a plasma, I guess, from the high voltage balun, is the reason for it is they basically distribute the electrons evenly throughout the inside of the bulb so that the entire surface more or less is charged equally and thus has light exiting the bulb equally. Is that the basic idea behind it?
Okay, I missed a couple of words, but I think you're talking about a fluorescent bulb, and I think you're asking why there is mercury in the fluorescent bulb. Before I proceed down that line, make sure I got the question correct. Don't want to go way off on a tangent here. KC2RFN, and I'm listening to you on the input when you occasionally get jammed. KQRIW, go ahead.
Yeah, that's correct. Is the mercury vapor just allowing the equal distribution of electrons throughout the bulb so that the phosphorus gets illuminated equally?
Yeah, good question. You're assuming that the electrons boiling off one filament going to the other end of the bulb is lighting the phosphor. Absolutely not. First of all, my understanding of a fluorescent bulb is that you want to create a plasma inside that bulb. What is a plasma? Plasma is a gaseous material that is so hot that the electrons of the individual atoms or molecules are no longer associated with that nucleus. They say, to hell with you, I'm not going to go around that nucleus. I'm going to go out free by myself. So these electrons are going off free. This plasma is a highly conductive negative impedance material. The mercury vapor is the plasma. the current flowing through that plasma creates extremely high temperatures. I don't know the exact number, but if someone told me it's 10,000 degrees Kelvin, I'd believe it. The ultraviolet rays coming off that plasma is what hits the phosphor and makes the phosphor light up. It's the ultraviolet rays, or x-rays, but I think it's ultraviolet rays, that's hitting the phosphor. See, in the case of a cathode ray tube, let me drop. In the case of a cathode ray tube, you've got a gun assembly that's in the neck of the tube. You've got a bunch of accelerating potentials that literally fire these electron bullets at very high velocity at the phosphor. They hit the phosphor and create light by impact. By impact creating instantaneous lots of energy. In the case of the phosphor that's around the perimeter of the tube, that's in the inside of the tube of the fluorescent bulb, there is no gun assembly aiming those electrons from the axis, from the center of the axis of the tube over to the phosphor. There is no gun assembly aiming the electrons that way. The best you could do, the electrons coming from one end to the other, is it would make a glancing blow on the phosphor. That wouldn't do it. So it's the ultraviolet rays coming off the mercury vapor that hits the phosphor, and that does the translation from ultraviolet to visible light. So the mercury is what's doing it. If the mercury wasn't there, you ain't got a fluorescent tube, is my understanding, Alan. I guarantee there's more to it, but that's my first understanding. KC2RFN, K2RAW.
Okay, and when the bulb is broken, what is it that is hazardous? Is it the phosphorus, or the mercury, or both?
Mercury is considered a toxic material. If it gets into your body, I know that it is a, I don't think it's a carcinogen, but I believe it does affect mental capacity. So you don't want mercury in your body. I think the phosphor is also, you're sort of asking which is more dangerous, the phosphor or the mercury. I think they're both pretty bad. I don't know which is worse. I don't know the mechanism. I don't know if it's carcinogenicity or if it's just a simple poisoning. But in either case, I don't think you want either one to get under your skin. Over to you, Alan, K2RAW.
KC2RFN. The reason I ask is I saw a movie called The 40-Year-Old Virgin. Yeah, it's an older movie, funny, stupid, but funny. And there's one scene in there where two of the stars are smashing real fluorescent bulbs on each other. You can see because the phosphorus is coming out. They're not swinging at each other's faces, but they're going about leg and waist, maybe even shoulder high. And I'm thinking, we all know that you're not supposed to be anywhere near broken fluorescent bulbs, although of course that's unavoidable in the real world. But here are these actors on set smashing these things at each other, and I'm wondering if there's if they really should have any concern. It's not just one or two. They were smashing them on the ground with great force and standing right in that particular area, and then smashing them on each other.
I'd like to believe that that was breakaway phony hardware that was actually done during the recording of that movie. I'd like to believe that that wasn't a real fluorescent bulb. Now, if a fluorescent bulb crashes to the floor in your kitchen and you walk over there with a dustpan and broom and sweep it up, as long as you're not breathing the fumes, I think you're moderately safe. If I now started using the fluorescent bulb like a baseball bat and smashing it against your body, I don't think I would get you in a lot of trouble, but just those chunks of glass, breathing the stuff that comes out of it, the whole scene is not good. How bad is it? I don't know. I'd like to believe in that movie, though, that was a fake breakaway hardware that they were doing during that recording. I'd like to believe it wasn't real fluorescence. Because if it was, the director of that movie was awfully naive and pushing his luck as I see it. And the fact that he put that in a movie is kind of bad news because it's going to give some bad guy some ideas. Over to you, Alan, K2RIW.
Well, when the Curlicues were coming out to take the place of real light bulbs, I recall hearing that if you break one of them, you have to don a hazmat suit and go through a whole protocol to clean it up. So, if they felt the need to inform the public of this, by the way, on a product they're shoving down the public's throat, which the public doesn't want, but that's a different conversation. Makes me think maybe there's something to it. You know what I'm going to do, Dick? I'm going to make it my business this week to find out what the reality is. Sometimes the written reality is a little different from the real reality, but I'm going to find out and I'll report back next week.
Yeah, run this by again, Alan. From what you just said, are you implying that if I took a complex fluorescent bulb and dropped it on the ground, or if I took a 48-inch long fluorescent tube and dropped it on the ground, in either case I break it, are you saying I'm supposed to wear a hazmat suit in order to clean up that debris? Is that what you have been told? Over to you, Alan, K2RIW.
That's correct. When the first resistance to the Curlicue lights came out, you know, the reason people are moving to Curlicues is because they're phasing out real, you know, electroluminescent light bulbs. Not because that's what we want or because it's better, but, you know, they're doing it, you know, who remembers that. Apparently that's getting forgotten, but that's out there. You can't just go and clean it up with the...
If that was true, Alan, I'm having great trouble believing that ordinary incandescent bulbs have been discontinued, and now we've got nothing but these compact fluorescent bulbs, and there's zillions of them in the environment. And you and I, when we buy them, are not being shipped, though, is with a great big safety warning label. So if they were that dangerous, they were that proliferate, that prevalent everywhere in the environment, there's an awful lot of missing information. Something's wrong here. So I can't believe they're that dangerous that they need a hazmat suit. Maybe the very early designs, but the current design, and... if you and I had to estimate the number of them that are in the environment right now and the number that are breaking every day because they fall out of the fixture because I didn't do a good job of installing it, I can't believe they're that dangerous. You'd be hearing a whole lot of stories of people going to the emergency room because they tried cleaning up their compact fluorescent bulb. KT2RFN, K2RIW.
This is Kendra. I thought it was absurd because... Look, I went to summer camp, and all we had were fluorescent bulbs.
Yeah, I've been listening to Alan on the input. Somebody's doing some kind of playing around. Either that or some of the mistakes, some of the modifications that Eric is making is such that I'm hearing Alan beautifully on the input, but he's not always coming through the machine. But the main point Alan's making is that he's heard these safety issues, and he's going to do further research this week to see if he can confirm how dangerous are compact fluorescent bulbs and the regular fluorescent long tubes that we're using. But for that many to be in the environment and where ordinary bulbs have been completely discontinued, I'm having trouble believing that we would put our public at that much risk, if there is that much risk on one of these being broken, because I guarantee 1,000 of them breaking per day somewhere in the United States. People are cleaning up the mess. And how come the label on the bulb doesn't tell us about all these dangers? Would our Environmental Protection Agency allow the manufacture, distribution, and sale of something that's that dangerous with no warning label? I'd like to believe our government wouldn't allow that. What do you think, Alan? KC2RFN, K2RIW?
Two more minutes, Dick.
Okay, so you're reading that the Environmental Protection Agency recommends that a person follow the safety procedures that are on that page because of the mercury vapor that's distributed during the breaking of that bulb. You're reading that from what brochure are you reading that from, Alan? And how come the rest of us haven't seen it? Why is that such a well-kept secret? So what were you reading, Alan? AC2RFN, K2RIW.
Okay, this is from the EPA.gov site. And I just Googled and clicked on it. And, you know, this is all about the mercury vapor escaping. And the reason you haven't heard about it, Dick, I mean, come on. You know how much politics went into discontinuing the electroluminescent light bulb? I mean, man, that was a feat. There's obviously a lot of money behind it and a lot of politics behind it. So what are they going to do? Tell the public we forced you to stop using a light bulb that's safe when you break it, and now we're going to force you to use a light bulb that isn't safe when you break it? But sure enough, here it is in the EPA. There's nothing in the EPA about cleaning up an electroluminescent light bulb or an LED light bulb. But there it is. It's cleaning up broken CFLs.
Okay, I'm going to have to find that website and read that. By the same token, the additives we've added to gasoline, are they really safer? And the fuel we're using now, I forget what percentage of it is alcohol-based, corn-based. I think there have been a few surveys showing that the total amount of energy required to plant, cultivate, harvest, ferment, and whatever, to go through the whole process of converting corn into a fuel is such that we're not coming out ahead. I know that I get much lower mileage on fuel that has alcohol-based. When I was traveling back and forth for 3 solid years to Utica, New York, to work at the Romeo Development Center, when I bought a tank of fuel on Long Island and drove to Utica, I essentially was empty when I got there. When I came back home each weekend, and I filled up a tank in Utica, where they have a much lower content of alcohol, or maybe none at all, I'm not sure which, I drove that back home, and I had 3/4 of a tank used, and I drove around for 2 or 3 more days on Long Island with the fuel that I bought in Utica. So there's a huge difference in mileage and fuel. So we're making this investment of alcohol-based fuel, and we think it's greener. I believe that the final studies are showing that we're not coming out ahead on this one, and yet for political reasons we've done it, and now we're going to stick to it. So it looks like compact fluorescent light bulbs and the complete discontinuation of a ordinary light bulb seems a little bit misguided, doesn't it? Yes, they're more energy efficient, but if they're that much more dangerous, if they're going to create problems in the environment downrange, are we going to be reading about it? Let me drop it. Do you think we're going to be reading a survey 5 years from now of the long-range health effects created by compact fluorescent tubes that were not treated in the best possible way, where if we ever broke one, are we supposed to bring the hazmat people in to clean up the debris if we break one of those? How far your reading of that EPA statement, did it give specific instructions as to what you're supposed to do if one of those smashes onto your kitchen floor, Alan? KC2RFN, K2RAW?
Absolutely. It goes through a ridiculous protocol during cleanup, before cleanup. Have people and pets leave the room, air out the room for 5 to 10 minutes by opening a window or door to the outdoor environment. Shut off the central forced air, heating, air conditioning if you have one. Collect materials needed to clean up the broken bulb. Use stiff paper or cardboard, sticky tape, whatever. During cleanup, do not vacuum, because obviously it'll throw it into the air. After cleanup, blah, blah, blah. Check with your local government about disposal requirements in your area, because some localities require fluorescent bulbs, broken or unbroken, to be taken to a local recycling center. There's no such requirement in the area. You can dispose of materials with your household trash. Well, you know, knowing the incredible, crazy, liberal, EPA-loving, you know, type politicians, it won't be long until you have to pay to get rid of your broken bolts or even your unbroken bolts. So I don't think they'll ever admit it, Dick. I don't know if it's really as dangerous as they make it out to be. Again, fluorescent bulbs have been breaking for years and years and years, and we haven't heard of any epidemics or problems associated with them. But that's not the point. The point is that the EPA actually has on here, you have to go through all these things, which you never heard of, and you're very tuned in, and you've never heard of this. There it is on the EPA website, right there, telling you how to treat this. And I know I read where you have to wear protective garments and rebreathers or whatever. All sorts of nonsense. Now, I think they would be downplaying it, Dick. Just another attempt at a liberal Shangri-La, which could never be achieved.
Question, Dick.
John recognized the chemistry inside of a 4-foot long fluorescent tube and the chemistry inside of a compact fluorescent light bulb, I think, are very, very similar. And we've had those fluorescent tubes around for a long period of time. Amazing. Go ahead, John. The people in Richmond County, they know how to treat this stuff a lot better, don't they, John? KC2R, here we go. Katie, here we go. You know who you are. KC2WGB, K2RIW. Thank goodness I'm not getting late.
KC2WGB. Very good, Dick. I have a question for Alan. We were told in our instructions with fluorescent materials that not only we know about the mercury and all that, we were told that the fluorescent element, if you get cut with it, the phosphor interferes with healing in a very bad way. I wonder if that's true or is that just an old wives' tale?
I remember that too, John, but I can tell you, I worked, I don't know how many hours in the ER, never once did I come across someone who had an issue with healing or infection from fluorescent-coated glass. And you know it happens all the time. In fact, I know I've cut myself on that glass when I was a kid. On more than an occasion, and here to tell the tale. I don't know, maybe I would have been smarter, I don't know.
Very good, yeah, I thought that might be a farce, but yeah, Dick, even Tyvek suits, it's crazy, it's just out of control.
Alan, you spent how much time in the ER, and are you saying you've never seen a patient come in claiming that, hey, this cut came from a fluorescent fixture, and you guys have got to protect me? You've never seen one of those, is what I think you're saying. Alan, go ahead.
Negative. Never heard that.
And you've been in the ER, have you been there as much as a year?
Years, Dick.
So, in those years, I guarantee you've seen some pretty gory things, particularly after automobile accidents. And all you've got to do is talk to a fireman who does MBA rescues. And boy, there are times when the description is, let's say, very graphic. And so my guess is you've had a few nightmares on some of the things you've seen. Is that true, Alan?
Yeah, they were learning experiences. But with respect to glass, it's really only in the eyes that it really became a big, big deal. Anything else, you can just basically dig it out or leave it.
So I guess it's an extremely delicate operation to remove a shard of glass that goes into an eye. And I'm suspicious that glass in the eye rather frequently is loss of that eye. Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, yeah, I don't even touch that. I just pass it on to the ophthalmological surgeon. I don't go anywhere near the eye. Just patch it and leave it alone. It's already patched usually by the time it comes in. So I wouldn't even attempt that.
When it comes to medical things, Dr. Oz has a fairly popular program. And on the show that was on this week, he was interviewing Barbara Streisand, who is on a movement to try to get those in medicine to better understand female coronary problems. She was claiming that most women fear most breast cancer, but coronary artery disease, she claims, is killing 10 times as many women as breast cancer. And that in the case of the female anatomy, a coronary symptom is very frequently misunderstood, misdiagnosed. Quite often it's considered to be a GERD or a heartburn or whatever. The person is given an antacid and sent home, and never even given an EKG. And so her main point is that the slight difference in anatomy and the way females act with coronary artery disease is frequently misdiagnosed, even in the better hospitals, seems to be her point. Wonder if you've seen evidence of that, Alan. KC2RFN, K2RIW.
course, a lot of the times it can be missed and misdiagnosed. Coronary issues can mimic a lot of things, and a lot of things can mimic coronary issues. Do your best to separate them. What I have an issue with, what you're talking about, that Barbara Streisand is talking about, is the separation of male and female medicine, as if women are a victim group and they're being neglected. That's what it sounds like, and that partisan doctors should pay more attention to their female patients, as if they're not. Believe me, we're fully cognizant of the fact that medical malpractice will come from both female and male patients. So I don't know where she's getting that from. Just creating another victim group, that's all.
She claims she has statistics to back up her claim that there's a significantly higher misdiagnosis of female coronary problems as opposed to male coronary problems. She wants us to believe that the female chemistry in the body is sufficiently different that the symptoms of coronary problems are more difficult to diagnose for female versus male. She thinks there's enough difference in chemistry and anatomy. That was her main point. And maybe she's overreacting, but she's hitting a whole group of people that are pushing that point of view, saying that that a significant change in OR procedures have to take place. She was essentially saying those words. And maybe she's created a crusade. Maybe she's got a little bit of reality there. It's not easy to tell. You've been on the front line, so from what you see, I think you're saying that a coronary event in a female anatomy versus a male anatomy, I think you're saying there's very little difference, and the symptoms have very little difference. Is that what you're saying, Alan? KC2RFN, KQRAW?
It never even occurred to me to think of a difference between the sexes, Dick. I'm trying to look back over my own history and see if I would have made the differentiation for any particular reason. I don't see myself doing that. This is Barbara Streisand we're talking about. She's an actress and a singer. Who cares what she says? I mean, really.
Yeah, there's a very nice program on PBS over the last couple of weeks on the subject of cancer. It's a total of a six-hour series in three separate programs of 2 hours each. And the main point that was made by the program is that around 1900, before cigarette smoking was popular, lung disease was an extremely rare disease. That when it occurred, physicians would say, come look at this, it's something you're never going to see. Once in a lifetime event type thing. And now when you plot cigarette smoking versus lung disease incidence, you see a strong correlation. And you probably have heard about that Veritasium video, which maybe I should mail you a copy of, in which Derek Mueller went around with a Geiger counter looking for the most dangerous locations of nuclear radiation, and the one that he found is quite surprising. KC2RFN, KQRAW.
Yeah, I remember us talking about this the last few weeks, and I find that fascinating and very believable because of the single cell membrane, a single cell membrane of the alveoli, and that is a great bee to put in the bonnet of smokers, because rather than it being some sort of ethereal, roll the dice, random chemical change in the DNA of the cells, thus leading to a cancer, people have a harder time seeing chemicals leading to a DNA change or disruption than they do radiation. Anybody who watched a 1950s movie about radiation, just believes to the core that nuclear exposure will lead to something very bad, almost a guarantee. And I think that would be great to educate the public as to what his findings are. And in fact, I've been proselytizing on it since I first heard you talk about it.
Did you get a chance to see that video? Did I mail you a copy of that, or did you find it? If not, I'm going to make sure you see a copy of that. And when it comes to the flight video that I mailed you a copy of, put all that information in the back of your mind, Alan, until you've completed your FAA written exam. They do not want to hear that information. Whether or not it's accurate is irrelevant. you've got to spout back very specific words that you were taught in your flight training. You've got to spout back those specific words in order to pass that test. Over to you, Alan. KGRAW.
Yeah, I'll be taking that written this week. And what's interesting is I was reviewing your review questions. Several of the questions relate directly to Bernoulli, and at least one or two of the distractor answers make a mockery of the article you sent me. So I'm going to bundle those together and send them to you from the official. These are official FAA written exam private pilot test questions. And one of the distractors is, you know, sometimes they throw in ridiculous distractor questions. And one of them is just stabs right at the heart of the article you sent me. So I'll send those that one or two over to you. You can see you get a chuckle out of it. But yeah, I'm going to suspend, what I read from what you sent from my mind when it comes time to take the test. And as I've said many times, even in medical school and college, I have to get the test out of the way before I can really learn the material. I don't know if that makes sense, but it's really worked well for me over the years.
Oh, in engineering, it's the same thing, Alan. The way we are taught electromagnetic theory is really way off to one side of the reality. I can't say it's wrong, but it's so far away from the reality of the way the art and science is really practiced. It's so disconnected. It is so far away from useful engineering information that you have to put it in one corner of your brain, and when you go out into the real world, you do not use what you were taught. And what you learn in the real world is the valuable information. The apprenticeship and the words you get from your friendly engineers who have been in the field for 10 or 20 years, you got to listen to them because they know which side of the bread is buttered. And the schools are not reacting properly. You would think there would be feedback where the schools would realize there's a huge disconnect in the way it's practiced versus the way it's taught. And it turns out that there is no feedback mechanism. The people who teach go on teaching. The people who engineer go on engineering. The people who engineer almost never go back to teaching. They couldn't tolerate that much cut in salary. And so there is no mechanism of feedback. And I've told you some of the encounters I've had with people who are hired as consultants in the engineering world who are also doing teaching, rare individuals. And those are striking contrasts that I see. We've only got about 3 minutes left. I'm not sure what we should be talking about. I'll toss the ball up and see if anybody's got a subject. If not, John's going to pick it up and give us one more of his thousands of mailbag requests. K2RIW listening.
Clint and 1YDY.
Go right ahead, Mike.
Alan, if you have my email, give me an email. I'd like to chat with you about you taking the test before you do.
Hey, you were a pilot for what? How many years, Mike?
Hank, and, I got sick in 09, so, you know, I did it from the time I was 18 for private and 21 for business, till I was 49 years old.
So you've got a healthy 25 years of piloting?
Like that. Been an instructor too, so I just wanted to comment on the difference between those who teach and those who do.
And Alan, I'm sure you've heard that what do pilots do? They pilot here and they pilot there. Go ahead, Alan.
Okay, Hank, I'll play up on QRZ and I'll drop you an email. What I was going to say before, Dick, is just what you said. Teaching has become an industry in of itself. It's getting over heavy of its own weight. People believe if they're in an institution long enough that they're smarter and they have the answers. And in reality, it's rarely them. It's usually the people who are out there in the real world who have the real answers. It may not be as well credentialed and lauded academically. But it's true. You get into areas like aviation, reality talks and BS walks, or planes crash. It's as simple as that. But in academia, so what if you design an antenna wrong and tell them how to design it wrong? It only works halfway. I still get my paycheck.
Yeah, but if I ever do finish this lecture that I'm working on, to discover that there are antennas, and there are antennas that are very well respected, the rules of thumb, that an antenna of this volume cannot exceed this amount of performance. And some of the antennas I've worked on have considerably exceeded those performances. So the rules of thumb that have worked very well until recently. So either I'm misinterpreting and crazy, or I'm on a little bit of a frontier as far as how antennas really work. And what really goes on inside of a dipole, from my point of view, is extremely exciting, extremely non-intuitive, and how the exact same piece of wire that couples the signal from the transmission line to the antenna can have 1 ampere of current flowing through it. And you just take that piece of wire, the semiconductor, and curve it around the corner where it becomes the dipole, and now there's 10 amperes flowing in that exact same piece of wire at right angles. Of course that's crazy. That's violation of Kirchhoff's law, which is supposed to be violated in this case. It's Faraday's law, not Kirchhoff's law. And Walter Lewin of MIT, with one of his experiments, with one of his videos, makes that very clear. And he's had fellow physics professors at MIT listen to his lecture saying, you've got to be wrong. That can't possibly be right. To which he says, I'm doing the demonstration and with real hardware. Let me drop it. I'm doing the demonstration with real hardware in front of you right now. Show me where the error is. Okay, we're going to be cut off in the next 40 seconds. This was TechNet number 1550. Be kind to each other, you guys. And science, you got to dig a little bit deeper. There's more to it than first meets the eye. KC2WGB, K2IW. Go ahead, John.
Yes, you'll need a bigger shovel. KC2WGB. I'd like to thank everyone for joining us on the net tonight, and hope you all come back next week, and we'll have some more fun. You guys be enjoying yourself out there, and happy Easter, and Passover, and whatever else. Back to you, Dick. KC2WGB.
Bye-bye, you all.
Night, everybody. It's Mike Brockle.
Just give me a call again. Isn't it Mars bounce instead of Moon's bounce these days, Barry?
I am thinking about it. I haven't had so much success. I believe it or not, I've tried, but nothing happened.
Barry, how's Richie doing?
Well, I was there to see him tonight. I think he's okay, but I don't think he's there. I think he's going to be there a little longer than he thinks, in my opinion.
Okay, Barry, thanks for the info. Tell him I said hi. And, I know he said he was only going in for a couple of days for some medicine adjustments or something, but I wish him well. Okay, KC2WGB clear.
Okay, John, I will definitely pass that. I'll probably speak to you tomorrow.
Okay. Barry.
Barry, did you get a chance to go out to, I think it was Shirley, to make that purchase for Rich?
No, I haven't gone yet. I get a feeling I'm not going to be able to do that until I get back from South Carolina. I'm kind of running out of time.
Yeah, when you get a chance, take a look at that YouTube video I recommend that you see, in which case it might scare you a little bit. Go ahead.
It's not going to scare me. I don't smoke. But I should show it to Richie.
Are you saying you have seen it?
Oh, I have not.
I think you should. It's very well done.
Okay, I'll try to look at it tonight.
Good luck. Bye-bye.
Night, all.
Thank you.
doing? Ah, doing good. Evidently, you got some things accomplished tonight. You all finished?
Half in a moment.
Well, at least you know it works. By the way, I tried the 902 tonight. That's not up either, so I guess you didn't get to that.
Yeah, well, I'm moving it away. I'm in the process now. I'm moving it. Well, I'm using the 900 megahertz antenna, Mr. Gunn. Should we?
Ah, okay. So, you gotta head home now?
Yeah, I gotta be at work in the morning. Why do you have home?
I didn't copy that. What'd you say?
Why do you have hum on your signal?
The hum on the signal? Ooh, 1-2, 1-2. I'm not sure. Nobody said anything before. Right. Hold on, let me check.
Actually, let me tune 85 and make sure it's nothing. Hey, give me a transmission.
TC2WGV, testing. 1-2, 1-2.
No, it's not on your signal. What's the link?
Okay. Hum is coming from the link, I think you said. All right. That's good to hear.
Yeah, good for you, not good for me.
How bad is it?
Oh, it's like a telephone hum. It's the foreground.
Okay, I think I'm detecting a hum on the dead carrier right from the repeater.
Well, what repeater are you listening to?
85.
No, I'm listening to Pulse 85, Derek Queen.
Right, that might be the PL, because I have the volume up a little loud.
No, you're using the TS-2000. You can't split it and put that filter on the right tone.
Okay, I just turned on my other receiver, and it's not on that receiver, which is filtered. Okay, that's it.
Yeah, I said I didn't get to listen to the tech that much. Had my nose and too much stuff in.
Yeah, and you didn't interfere, basically. It was just a couple of times where we lost it. But, yeah, it went well.
Yeah, well, unfortunately, this is the only time I had to do this stuff, so I did it.
What time you got to be in tomorrow?
No, pretty early. Not as early as I have been. But, nah, I'll get there before you.
Yeah, better go home and get some sleep. Ooh, 8 o'clock after this. Dang, you still got, what, another 15 minutes to get home?
No, I'm in Stone. It's going to take about a half hour.
Wow, yeah, I'm copying you real well. No problem at all. Didn't realize you were out that far.
NY2H.
Oh, just the man I want to talk to. NY2H, welcome aboard. KE2J.
Yeah, yeah. What are you doing out here?
No, I'm setting up the new link. I also took care of the problem. Problem was the modem flash memory doesn't work.
You swapped it out? New modem? What'd you do?
Yeah, I bought the modem out from Plainview. We're not using it at the moment. I'm going to take it up, put it for you here. Interesting thing, I don't know if you ever bothered to try and bring up the homepage of the Zoom modem while it was booting, and you'll see that when it loses power, it doesn't know the parameters for the DSL. It's just...
All right, so that's the issue. Yeah, I guess I was there 2 days ago or 3 days ago. When I say I shut off the Master 2 power.
Yeah, I saw that. Actually, after I get this junk working, I'm going to have a cabinet rewire party, because I'm going to take stuff out and dense it and make it nice and neat.
Sounds like a plan. How you doing, John?
Okay, Lou. What have you been up to? Haven't spoken to you in a few days. Keep busy, I hope?
Well, you know, we had the holiday break. Celebrated Hanukkah Friday, Easter today. Yeah, I've been busy. I put a database together for the club for field day, string, etc. I understand you still have the issue with the 8.1 professional. So, there you go. I don't know. I heard you talking to someone earlier this evening, and you said that someone came over with regular 8.1 and it worked. Yeah, it worked on my machine too here, and I've got the regular one, so maybe you're onto something. It's the professional edition.
Yeah, Lou, that seems to be the direction it's heading, but I won't know for a couple of days. I've got a few queries going in, some friends of mine that are going to check it out, and I really don't need it because I have enough computers to operate a calling, but it would be nice. By the way, Eric, how did your party go the other night, your double festival?
What are you talking about, the engine flight experience?
The Seder Easter table.
Oh, well, I'm not eating for another week.
All right. See, he knows what counts, Lou.
Yeah, I felt the same way. Oh, you should call it Eastover.
Yeah, that's what they call it, Eastover.
Ah, that's a good one, Eastover. Yeah, I'll go along with that. So, what are you doing this week, Luke? What do you got planned? Anything big?
Nothing big, you know. I had some dental work done, and they put in a temporary crown, because they want to wait 8 weeks to see if it doesn't flare up again. And they'll put the permanent, but a dentist uses, I guess, cheap glue because it keeps coming off. And last time it was my fault because I had a jelly bean. But this morning I was flossing. It came out. So I assume I have a dental appointment this week sometime. This was about back and left of my voice. Friday I'm having a bed delivered. And between, who knows.
Hello?
Yes?
Now, if the cap is on temporary, don't floss, because it's really a weak cement, and anything that will tilt the cap at an angle will break the bond. So when it's finally permanent, he's going to use a glue that requires ultraviolet light to cure it.
Yeah, I know. I guess it's my fault. I don't know. She hasn't been charging me, but this is going to be like the... Well, I was just in last week. Same thing, so I don't know. I didn't say don't floss, but I guess it makes sense. I don't know what she has to say. But anyway, yeah, but you think it'd be have a little strength to it, but apparently it doesn't have much strength at all. I guess that's because they want to take it off eventually, so.
Yeah, sugar daddies are not good either. But why don't you just get her to give you a tube of the glue and take care of it yourself for now?
You know, if you're going to floss it on that too, just push it down and then slide it out. Don't pull up. That's what usually happens.
Yeah, that could have been it too. You know, it's a whole thing. It's the other time, the first time, I forgot. You know, you forget because there's no pain. The thing is fine. The time, yeah, you're right. I mean, but I wasn't thinking. So eventually she's going to have to start charging me. Please. You know, she's been... Because what happened was they had to do some other dental work. Had a crown on there. And I had to do a new root canal, so she sent me to somebody else for that. And he drilled through it, and eventually he broke it. But she said she would replace it for free, although she charged me for the build-up, which is done. But, you know, I know I'm costing her hours every time I have to go back, so I don't know how long free is going to be free.
Yeah, well, you can ask them how long they want to leave it before they make it permanent, because if it was irritated and the nerve was, getting full of bacteria, that's probably not the things that you want to have happen, but you just said that they're going to do a root canal, so they're going to kill the nerve.
No. They did root canal like 17 years ago, and then like a month or two, three ago, whatever, started hurting, and so they did a re-root canal because they said they recently learned that sometimes there are micro roots. They didn't know that before, but now they use all sorts of microscopic equipment, etc. And so he went in there and he redid the old ones, and he found another one, and he did that one, and it still hurt a little. So then they put a drain in there. I sound like Richie. Whatever. All the photo details. But anyway, so, but that's all done. It's all sealed up. So they just want to go 8 weeks before they put anything permanent on it, just to make absolutely sure that it's not going to flare up again. But yeah, the nerves essentially are gone. Gone for 17 years.
So I got you. Well, root canal is not a good thing. It's really bacteria generated. So as long as they clean it, you know.